It's to the best of our knowledge. I'm Anne Strainchamps. There are people who love movies, and then there are people who really, really, really love movies.
I met my wife when we were working together at Point Cinema in Madison, Wisconsin.
This is Mark Rickers. He's married to Lori Gebhardt.
The theater that Lori worked at, I was sent there to cover for an evening.
I wasn't a manager at the theater yet, so you had to come over and babysit the staff. And we fought over all the silly little things that you're supposed to do at Point that you guys didn't do at Eastgate.
There's like little things they did differently, but they seemed really important back then.
Point was better.
We spent the whole night talking about movies that we loved.
I found your number on Facebook and I called you. Do you want to go out sometime? And you're like, yeah, sure.
The first movie we saw together was Stardust.
At Point.
And
that was our first date.
Neither of us can remember much about it.
I don't remember.
I don't know if we were both really nervous or what the deal was.
Kind of reminded me of like a
Princess Bride
Shakespeare play or something.
I know we have it on Blu-ray now because it seems important. When we got engaged, it kind of occurred to us, we've been hanging out in movie theaters for so long.
It's almost like a movie, like, oh, we met in a theater. Now we get married in one.
The Orpheum Theater is a historic movie house, movie palace in Madison. By this point, they were not showing movies anymore. One of the things that they were doing to keep the place afloat was booking weddings.
We didn't really have to do anything to the Orpheum to make it look beautiful because it already did.
Beautiful curtains and
paintings on the ceiling.
We actually put our band in one of the opera boxes, which they loved.
Chandeliers and
the sign out front is in all of our pictures.
I like the balcony. That's where we actually got married. That's where our ceremony took place.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, making their stage debut as husband and wife here at the Orpheum Theater, Mark Rickers and Lori Gebhardt.
Mark is our digital producer, and yes, he and Lori did get married in an old movie theater. Problem is, it's not a movie theater anymore. And that's a familiar story. Pretty much everywhere you look, movie theaters and performance spaces are in trouble. Box office attendance is down, but you know what's up? At-home movie streaming. So what happens when everyone stays home and the movie palaces and the multiplexes go dark? What are we losing? I mean, the web is not a place, is it? Matt Lambros has been traveling the country taking photographs of historic movie palaces, like the Orpheum. Big, ornate, beautiful places with grand marquees and chandeliers and gilded walls. Now, some cities have found creative ways to reuse these spaces, but in others, they're just empty ruins. Matt sees them all as lost treasure.
When I was growing up, I was always attracted to movies that showed like dystopian futures or books about Pompeii or the supposed lost city of Atlantis, the Titanic, just ruins in general. And that is sort of what this is to me. The theaters that I photograph, they're modern ruins.
Was there a gateway theater, like the first old abandoned theater you saw that you just couldn't stop thinking about?
Yeah, that would be the Lowe's Kings Theater in Brooklyn, New York. I had been photographing abandoned asylums for a number of years, and I was looking for something that was sort of the opposite, somewhere where people went to have fun. I ended up discovering the Lowe's Kings Theater, and I couldn't stop thinking about it, and I went and photographed it, and I was immediately hooked. And yesterday, I actually photographed my 99th closed theater.
Do those spaces still feel happy to you, or do they feel sad? Because I look at the photographs in your book, and they look so sad.
They do. because once you start, like, on the surface, you go in and you see how dilapidated the buildings have become. But there's always things to find, whether it's old ticket stubs, candy wrappers from the 60s, old movie posters. You know, you find people just posting online talking about, my grandfather used to take me to this theater, and it's a wonderful memory that I have and I'll have for the rest of my life. And I get contacted by those people, too. I get emails from people saying, you know, I've walked by this building for 10 years, and my grandmother told me she used to go here with my grandfather. And I've always heard stories about it, but I've never seen the inside, so thank you.
So I want to see one through the eyes of a photographer. Like, I want to see what you're looking at and what you're thinking about. I don't know, take us to the Paramount in Newark.
Okay. First thing I do when I get to a theater, I take a seat. And I just take in what details are left in the theater, what hasn't fallen, what do I want to capture. So... are you familiar with the Batman villain Two-Face?
Yes.
So when I first photographed it, if you're looking at the stage, the right side was all intact. But the left side had all fallen. I think the box seats were, you could see the openings of them and a little bit of plaster work around it. But for the most part, it was all on the ground.
Is it dangerous?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you know, but I've been doing this for quite some time, so I know where not to step. Like, the stage is usually very rotted. Most of the theaters I've been in, there's either a giant hole in the stage or it feels like you're stepping on a sponge.
You know, a lot of these spaces have been repurposed multiple times over. First for stage shows and musicals, and then came vaudeville, and then silent film, and then the talkies, and then, you know, more recently, live music and comedy. Does repeated reinvention like that take a toll on the space, or do you think it enriches it?
I think it definitely enriches the space. Like, if a theater became a church, there's two in New York City that I can name. The former Lowe's 175th Street Theater is now the United Palace, and they're actually starting to flip around, and they still have church services, but they're doing concerts. They're having special movie events. So they're sort of turning it back into a community space beyond it being just a church. And there's also the Lowe's Valencia, which is now the Tabernacle of Prayer for All People in Jamaica, Queens. And that one, it was really funny to me because there were statues above the proscenium arch of Greek gods and goddesses, and they were all naked. So they couldn't have that in a church. So they took them down and had someone add robes to them. And then they put them all back. Oh, and wings. So they're angels now.
What's the most interesting reuse of a movie palace that you've seen?
Oh, geez. Probably the Michigan Theater in Detroit. The theater, after it closed as a movie theater, became a performing arts center. And when that closed, it was around when Detroit was starting to get pretty bad. And it's attached to an office building. And the people who worked in the building were having problems. People were breaking into their cars, stealing their cars. And basically, they were concerned about that. And they told the owners, you need to provide us with a parking garage. So they were going to demolish the theater and build a parking garage. But when they sent out structural engineers, they found out that if they demolished the theater, it would weaken the structural integrity of the office building. So what they did is turn the theater into a parking garage. So they gutted it and built a parking garage into it, but they kept the ceiling and the top of the proscenium arch and the top of the lobby. And if you go into that and you park your car and turn around, it looks like they basically took a cross section of the theater and just left it. So you turn around, you can see the top of the balcony, you can see the projection room, but you can also see all the guts of the theater basically are just on display.
I just don't even know what to think about that. That sort of seems so perfect, right? Like, we demolished or abandoned these gorgeous public spaces and, you know, instead we became car culture, all of us in our little atomized cars, our own little interior lives there. Yeah. It seems so fitting.
It's very weird. Someone bought the building a couple of years ago and said he was going to return it to its former glory, but I haven't seen any evidence of that happening.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you so much for showing us some of these places. They're beautiful.
Well, you're welcome. That's my whole goal on this, is to just document these spaces before they're gone. You
must remember this. Matt Lambros is an architecture photographer based out of New York. And you can see his photos of theaters all over the country in his book, After the Final Curtain. We also put a few of them up on our website.
Certainly in the context of music and stuff, I think it's really just about the people who want to be engaged in creativity are in charge of the means of production and the execution of their art.
That's Matt Conboy. In 2007, he founded the creme de la creme of indie music spaces, New York's Death by Audio. This was a do-it-yourself, DIY space where musicians not only practiced and performed, they also lived together. Death by Audio sparked the now famous New York indie scene of the 2000s, but then came gentrification. And surprisingly, it was Vice Media, the hip New York website, that came in and killed Death by Audio.
So instead of going to a traditional big music venue that's very nice and very proper and it's all sweet, but it's owned by Live Nation, you know, it's maybe younger people or creative people who are like, I really want to do this for myself and I want to do it as an art project and I want to do it because I love it, not because I want to get rich or make money. I think that's really what DIY is about, and that's why it kind of doesn't really have much to do with a particular genre of music, right? Like, you know, you could do this with electronic music or jazz or rock or whatever.
2007 was the first time I played, and like, it was a real shithole, but it kept getting better and better, and the sound got better, and there were locks on the bathroom doors, and then there was soap in the bathroom, and you couldn't even believe it. Why would you keep improving it? And it's because it comes from a place of love.
When we first kind of rented that space that we turned into a music venue, it was like, it was kind of a really like a bleak storage room almost. It was just dark and had like really crappy drop ceiling, and it seemed like a place for like a secretary to just waste away in obscurity or something. But you know, I think we were also young and creative or whatever, and the kind of people who look at that and they're like, ooh, well, what are the possibilities here? Like, oh yeah, we could fit a stage in here. We could make, you know, we could put a show on.
It's just this very comfortable, very friendly, democratic space. And it's so rare these days to have that.
It just seems like home. I think it's nice to go somewhere where you feel comfortable.
It's always been a good time, and I feel fortunate to have said this has been my job. I mean, are you kidding me? Me?
It was, for the most part, really inspiring and fun. I mean, for someone like me, I think, and like a lot of our roommates who just want to be creative and want to be around creative people, there's a kind of, I don't know, like a visceral energy that you can tap into when maybe you're having a bad day, but your, you know, roommate is like super inspired, and then that inspires you. Or maybe you go down the hall and see a band that you've never heard of and they're amazing, and then you go in your room and you write a song.
It's interesting to think that when I first started coming to shows here, I was just discovering all of this stuff that now basically defines my life.
So when I came to DBA, everyone was just there for the music. Like, they knew that there was something special that was going to happen that night.
The short version is that Vice Media decided they wanted to kick us out of our place. You know, I talked to Eden, my like partner in running the venue, for the majority of the time. You know, we would talk about what we thought might happen, and you know, it seemed pretty likely that someone was just going to bulldoze our building and put condos in there, and we felt like that would be pretty fitting. There was like hints of betrayal, the fact that it was Vice, and I think that just got worse the worse they treated us. Yeah, I mean, it was weird. It definitely felt like one of those things, like, it was just like a completely unnecessary conflict and hostility and like dismissal, where it's like, what, you know, you're like a guy on top of a castle, like picking out some person on the ground and saying, that guy, I want to spit on that guy right there. You know, when we started this, it's not like we were experts. We just figured it out, you know? And I think that that's part of, you know, it's part of like, make it your own, whatever. If it doesn't, you don't, it doesn't have to do with music. Start a DIY dance studio, you know? Like, what is missing in your cultural life that you want to have happen?
But I'm kind of sad, you know? It's okay to realize, like, this space that's been such a big part of my life and all of our lives is not gonna be here, but it's okay. And we're just gonna go and expand into new spaces and figure out new things. So let's find home. Like, this has been a home for us for many years. We played our first show here in July of 2007. 7.5 years ago. It was a beautiful night. Let's go home, y'all, let's go home.
Matt Conboy co-founded Death by Audio. He made a documentary about it called, appropriately, Goodnight Brooklyn. If you want to see it, go to our website at ttbook.org. So it's easy to take places for granted until they disappear. When my favorite bookstore closed, it ripped a hole in my heart, a hole Amazon will never fill. Have you lost a community space that mattered to you? Tell us about it on our Facebook page. Or join the conversation there about whether anyone still goes to the movies. And coming up, if you think the MP3 killed music, think again. It's Bandcamp to the rescue. I'm Ann Strainchamps. It's to the best of our knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio. 'Cause I've been waiting on you. And PRX.
It is a cliche at this point, but punk rock absolutely 100% saved my life.
Music journalist Jess Skolnick.
I was a bad kid because I had been treated badly, you know? And I got into drugs way early. So finding punk was like walking into a show and being like, oh my God, there's a place where I can make art out of my pain, and there are other people who are doing it too. Just watching people move and watching people have that kind of emotional catharsis, both on stage and off, it helped me get clean, it helped me get onto a path where I was just obsessed with music and writing about music and making music and providing spaces to make music and being part of this world just obsessively. Channeled all of my hurt and pain into being creative. It absolutely saved me. And I think it's that for so many of us. Like, that's, it's a cliche because, like, that's true, is that wounded people need a place to make art.
All right, Heather.
But what happens when that place doesn't exist? What if you're, like, a teenager stuck in some small town in Idaho and there's not a music venue in sight? Plus, your parents hate your music. Jess Skolnick says, thank God for Bandcamp, the website where bands can sell their music and connect with fans all over the world. Jess writes for Bandcamp Daily. Articles like 9 Essential Net Labels from Mexico's Electronic Underground and 10 Bands Setting Iceland's Black Metal Scene Ablaze. Charles Monroe Kane reads all that stuff because he loves finding new music. He's on every platform there is. Spotify, Pandora, SoundCloud, Soma FM, Mixcloud. And lately, he told Jess, he's feeling a little overwhelmed.
You had this great thread on Twitter about how you deal with new music overload. And you did this thing, you reconnected with an album you listened to when you were young.
It's actually something that I do probably once a week. I wanted to sort of reconnect with the real joy that I had in discovering music. So a record that I really loved when I was a kid was Kate Bush, The Red Shoes.
You were like a cool kid, man. Wow, I was listening to Bob Seger. Jesus.
I wasn't cool. My parents were. I started going to punk shows when I was really young because my parents took me. Ugh. I started going when I was, this was in 1990, so I was 11 years old when I started going to punk shows.
When I was a young man, I listened to like Bon Jovi and Kiss, and I didn't, then I moved to Europe, and when I get to Europe, I went to a rave, and I was at this rave listening to repetitive, grungy, repetitive, nasty, mm-hmm. full-on techno, and I was like, oh my God, I didn't even know what was happening. I thought maybe something was broken at first.
Right.
And I fell in love with it. It like changed my life. I think if I would have heard that music on a record player or on the radio with some friends in Amsterdam, I wouldn't have gotten the same effect out of it. I had to be there, right?
Totally, totally.
So when these venues, as we know, venues are shutting down left and right, where are the people going? Are they just going to Bandcamp? Are they quitting? I mean, where's that energy going, do you know?
I've talked to a lot of younger musicians who kind of grew up on the internet in a way that I didn't. Like you said, you and I really grew up, you know, having that live music experience be our gateway into underground music. But I look at Facebook groups all the time where kids are swapping Bandcamp links. You can be a kid in your bedroom in some incredibly remote town where there isn't a scene and there isn't any connection to anybody. And you can hear music that you're inspired by and talk to people that you're inspired by. I talked to one musician who went on tour with somebody that she'd never met before, but they were like mutual appreciators of each other's music and planned a tour together.
In my house, my son listens to Pandora because I make him listen to, he's 12, and it's got more friendly stuff on there so you can have the swear words beeped out. My daughter likes Spotify. My wife listens to Apple Music. I listen to SoundCloud and Mixcloud. I have lots of friends with Bandcamp pages. It's overwhelming. There's so much music out there. If I want to mix up my listening, how do I begin? Give me some advice where to go with that.
That's honestly really what The Daily is there for, providing a space for people who are interested in discovery. So we've done lists on things like Latin American prog and emo in China.
Wow.
And it's about finding those connections and a person from inside that scene who can tell you about how vital it is and all of the interesting music that's happening within it in a way that will help you make sense of it from outside.
You and I know that the concert experience can be some of the great experiences of your life, yet the experience you're out dealing with right now is a very virtual one.
Totally.
Would you want the scene to be only online? Would that be desirous?
It's hard. It's hard. My personal anecdote there is that I have been working on trying to open a nonprofit above ground all-ages venue in Chicago for the past, almost 5 years now. We are very well organized, and we had a horrible, horrible time finding a place.
Why? What happened?
There are particular laws here. They're tax laws, and they allow commercial buildings to be written off if they stand vacant. So if the value of a property in rent is less than the value that it would be written off.
Bummer.
Yeah, a commercial real estate company will let it stand empty. And so there's tons and tons and tons of empty spaces that won't rent out.
That's all you really need, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's it. Just need the physical space.
Yep. There are so many artists out there. There's an endless world of creativity. If you look at that world of people on Bandcamp that is huge and getting huger by the day, you provide a physical space for people and they will come.
How can we help young people pull this off? Because they're going to need help with the fire codes, because fire codes are not very punk rock and not very sexy, but they're going to need some, a little bit of help.
I know a lot about fire codes now from doing all this stuff.
Yeah.
Like if you've got nonprofit experience, if you've got just the guide to setting up a 501c3, if kids in your area are trying to set up a nonprofit art space, if you can help kids through paperwork, the proper licensing, the proper, you know, all of that stuff. And also fair housing, gentrification, all of these things are totally connected. So our job is just to stick around. It's like, come out to a show, support younger bands, and stick around for them. Like, don't just check out and be like, oh, I have kids. I don't care about this anymore.
I could imagine if I was 19 right now listening to you, especially if I was a fan, not a musician, I'd be like, screw it. I'm just going to go online. That's where I'm going to enjoy my music. I'm not going to try to do the physical space. Is there a place where DIY can be done there?
Yeah, absolutely. There's certainly a place where DIY can be done. It's not quite the same experience, and it doesn't feel the same to me because I'm old, but I think it provides that same nurturing and that same sense of wonder and expression for a lot of younger kids, and I think that's huge. I don't think that online spaces can be discounted. When you're making music, and this has been the case in every band that I've ever been in, that's me speaking in a different language, a hard language. It comes out of a really gut place in me that I can't always speak from when I am talking normally. That can be an incredible thing to connect to, and that's what I connected to at that very first punk show. And the thing that has kept me carried through music is just that it's an incredible tool for communication and connection, even when you're not right there with somebody.
And it doesn't matter if it's a physical space. It doesn't matter if it's an online space. You know, her life was still saved by rock and roll, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
Jess Skolnick talking with Charles Monroe Kane. Jess is a music journalist and the managing editor of Bandcamp Daily. Once upon a time, seeing art meant a visit to the Met or the Louvre, walking reverentially through hushed galleries where security guards lurk in the corners. Well, not anymore, because art has escaped. It's out in the world now, on sidewalks, in abandoned buildings, in the sky, even underwater. And Hans-Ulrich Obrist loves it, which is significant because he's one of the most influential art curators in the world. So a few things to know about him. Hans is from Switzerland. He knows everyone. And he has an unbelievable amount of energy. The New Yorker calls him the curator who never sleeps. Plus, as Steve Paulson discovered, he talks really fast.
It's very fascinating if we see art where we expect it least. And so I started to think, where could I do these exhibitions? And the solution was actually in front of my own door, actually within my own apartment, which is my own kitchen. So Fish Levi's said, you know, why are you not doing an exhibition in your apartment? And then they visited my flat and they realized that because I never cook, so that the kitchen was also full of books. And so they made a joke and they said, you know, we should actually liberate your kitchen from all these books. And make it into a real kitchen. And so that somehow became the kitchen show. At the same time, we had Hans-Peter Fellmann, who preferred the fridge. He installed, marble eggs.
Eggs made out of marble?
Yeah, marble eggs and feathers, so one couldn't eat them.
And then didn't you have a film under the sink?
Exactly. There was also a filmed candle under the sink. There was also actually installation in the toilet, so that went from the kitchen show to the toilet exhibition. So in a way, It was really using the apartment. And the exhibition lasted for 3 months and had about, I would say, 40 visitors, and it became a rumor. The few people who saw it told it to all their friends. So within a few years, many more people, you know, thought they had seen it. So it became a kind of an oral history in some way. The word curating is everywhere. I mean, basically, restaurants are being curated. Clothing retailers talk about curation. And, you know, of course, it's used for DJs. It's used in social media strategies. But, I mean, the fact that curating is being used in a greater variety of contexts than ever before, there's a certain resonance, I think, between the idea of curating and the contemporary idea of the creative self, this idea of sort of floating freely through the world, making of choices.
When did you first realize you wanted to be a curator?
Yeah, I would say it started as a teenager. I always think that I somehow was born in May 68 in Zurich, and I was born a second time in May 85 in the studio of Swiss artist Peter Fischli and David Weiss. And for me, this first visit in the studio became very much a eureka moment. I arrived there, I was 17 years old, and had seen their exhibition and was so excited by that I, you know, wanted to kind of see their work in the studio. They were kind enough to show me around and spend an afternoon with me.
You were in your late teens, early 20s, and it sounds like you would just kind of go knocking on the doors of these famous artists, and amazingly, they would talk to you.
Yeah, it was very was a very wonderful moment because it was like my grand tour in a way, because I always had read that Goethe and the writers of previous centuries had gone on this grand tour to Italy and would spend several months, sometimes several years, just learning. And I wanted to kind of learn and look and look. And so I just by night train, you know, would travel all over Europe, and I didn't really have money for hotels, so I would always sleep on the night trains and get to the next city and then meet artists. And on one of these night train journeys, I met Alighiero Boetti, and he said it's very, very difficult for an artist to always be invited to do the same things. Artists are invited to do exhibitions, they're invited to do things in art fairs, but he said there are so many other things as an artist he wanted to do, but he's never really invited to do. And so he said, he gave me this very important piece of advice where he said that he really thinks as a curator I should somehow ask artists what they really wanted to do, what are their unrealized projects, what are the projects which cannot happen within the framework of society, within the existing institutions, and then think what could I do to actually make those projects happen. And that was probably single-handedly the most important advice anybody had ever given me, because ever since, I would ask the artists I meet always, you know, what is your dream, what is your concrete utopia, and then, you know, I would again and again try to make these projects happen, to somehow produce reality. I think what is so important is what we can do together. So, for example, you know, the other day we gathered artists and solar inventors to actually start to think about what could be the solar airplane. And I mean, we've got such huge problems and issues and questions to be addressed in the 21st century that we have to pool all these competencies.
And is that something that you need artists for, to help build a solar airplane?
Yes, absolutely. This idea of actually, you know, doing it... I think doing something with someone else and doing something for someone else is maybe what is to say. But I think it's very difficult to answer it generally. I think it's always concrete situations, you know.
You write that one of your childhood heroes was the early 20th century impresario Sergei Diaghilev, who founded the Ballet Russe and worked with all kinds of major artists like Stravinsky and Picasso and Cocteau. Why did you find Diaghilev so inspiring?
Yeah, I think I was, first of all, of course, very inspired by artists. And then, at a certain moment, I realized that, in a way, if I wanted to understand the forces which are effective in art, I needed to somehow understand what's happening in science, what's happening in music, what's happening in literature. And I started to do exactly the same what I had done in visual arts with these other art forms. I would go and visit architects in their studio. I would go to scientists to visit their lab. I would go to meet composers. And then I started to think, I mean, what would it mean actually to curate not only art, but to curate in a more interdisciplinary way? And it's really then that I somehow all of a sudden came across Diaghilev, I was probably about in my early 20s, and realized that he, in a similar way to me, had actually started out to be a curator of painting, to be a curator of visual arts exhibition, but then had this idea of bringing all the art forms together, and for this reason founded in 1909 the Ballet Russe. And that's, for me, was a huge shock, because I was suddenly thinking, maybe one could do such a thing for our time. Maybe I could curate opera, maybe exhibitions where I would mobilize not only visual artists, but also composers, also architects. And that it's something, you know, I've tried to do ever since in lots of different situations.
Hans Ulrich Obrist is a curator at the Serpentine Gallery in London. He talked with Steve Paulson. Coming up, wrap your head around this.
I went to the woods because I wished to live deliberately, to front only the essential facts of life, and not, when I came to die, discover that I had not lived.
Henry David Thoreau's Walden Pond, The Video Game. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRX. Henry David Thoreau's Walden has inspired a whole lot of readers to get outdoors, contemplate nature, smell the pine tar. Now, it's a video game. No, seriously. Tracy Fullerton made it. She told Steve Paulson a video game is a great way to get to know good old Henry David.
I hope that you actually begin to have an emotional connection to him as a person. A lot of times when we're taught about great writers, we're sort of taught that they were these sort of stodgy people, you know. But Thoreau was a young man when he went out to the woods, and he had experienced some very deep tragedies. And those are some things that we let the player explore and come to an understanding that he's a philosopher, he's a naturalist, he's also a person. So you start down right by the sort of frame of his cabin on July 4th, 1845, when he went down to the woods to begin. And you can get right to work and finish that cabin if you like. You can start hoeing his bean field. Or you can, you know, take a quieter path maybe and just go for a walk in the woods. But as you start to discover the world, what you're really seeking is balance.
And there are things that you have to do. You got to find food. You got to have shelter. I mean, you have to pound those nails to build the cabin.
You do. You have to do those things or you'll become very weak. But you never die in the game. The conceit is that he lived very close to town, very close to friends, and that had he collapsed, they would have found him. And so if you collapse in the game, you know, you actually wake up by a fire. You hear a friend, oh, are you okay? Here, we helped you, you know.
Oh, you found my home. Good for you, Henry.
These are friendly woods that Thoreau
friendly
was
woods.
Living in.
Yes. Exactly.
So there are trade-offs. I mean, you can spend a lot of time out in the woods sustaining yourself, you know, foraging for nuts or food or whatever. You can also go hang out with your intellectual friends like Ralph Waldo Emerson or Bronson Alcott.
July 1845. My dear Henry, Mr. Emerson has assisted my family in acquiring a house near Concord. And there we are now. Writing and living like philosophers, which is to say, with little but happily. Yours truly, A. Bronson Alcott.
As with all mentor-mentee relationships, eventually there's a tension there between doing as your mentor wants you to do and breaking off on your own, which they had historically, and that plays out in the game as well.
Fascinating. Of course, there is a huge irony also in all of this. I mean, Thoreau valued being close to nature. He famously wrote, "In wildness is the preservation of the world." He believed in self-reliance, basically, you know, using his own hands to survive. And here you are creating a game where the entire experience of nature and survival all happens in the digital world.
I think that that's true. And yet I think you could say the same thing about a book. I mean, a book itself is not nature. It's a piece of media about nature. You know, the interesting thing about Thoreau is that he probably wouldn't have been a game player, but he had a very sort of strong engineering mind, and I think he would have been interested in how the game was made and the level of detail that we put into building the simulation, which we built on his own surveys with accurate animal sounds, and all of the animals and plants change over the course of the year. All based on his descriptions and a sort of detailed coding of his text. So I think he would have been, you know, very interested in the underlying architecture of the game, to be honest with you.
It's so interesting because, I mean, you could have created a lot of this world. I mean, this multimedia world of the journals of Thoreau and audio recordings of letters by Ralph Waldo Emerson and other people, but you wouldn't necessarily have to turn it into a game. By gamifying it, what changes?
I think that what changes here is the sense that it's your experiment. So we put you down in the woods in Thoreau's shoes, so to speak, but you make the choices. And a lot of times players want to push against what they perceive as the expectations of a game. So they don't want to just stay down in the woods. They want to go to the town and they start earning money and they want to buy nice clothes. And all those things are possible in this game. You can actually live a life contrary to that Thoreau would have chosen himself.
How long did it actually take to make this game?
It took 10 years. So
10 years.
Yeah, you have to understand the team. It was a labor of love. So it's not that we went to work full time on this for 10 years. We all did it in addition to our other jobs. But 10 years from the day that I went out and bought the team all copies of the book and we basically sat down and started reading it together to the day that we launched it.
Did anything change in your own life as you immersed yourself in Thoreau's philosophy? I mean, did it make you think about anything differently?
Well, I mean, this is perhaps too much information, but as I was developing this game, I actually, I had breast cancer. I discovered I had breast cancer, and I had to go through a really intensive period of my life, and that was followed by some other intensive losses. And what happened for me was I was most interested in the philosophy in the beginning. And as we continued researching and understanding, you know, the book, I began to see the threads of how his own losses and his own life were actually there under the surface of what is, he is a particularly stoic writer, but you can actually see those threads under the writing.
Who do you see playing this game?
Well, that's a great question because the most unusual people write to me and say, well, I've never thought of playing a video game, but I want to play this one. And that makes me really happy. I can't predict who those people are going to be, but the letters that we've gotten are from people that they're not gamers. They've never even been attracted to playing a game. And yet they saw this somewhere and they said, that is the game for me, right? And they're so grateful and interested. And these are people that have been completely ignored by the game industry. I think what I would call them is lifelong learners, and this game has found them.
Do you see this, what you've done here with this game of Walden, as a template for how you can create other kinds of spaces like this for other classic works of literature or philosophy?
I don't know if I'd see it as a template because I think each one would have to be addressed on its own. But I'm very interested in possibly, you know, taking on new pieces of literature or history. It's a fascination of mine, this notion that we could build spaces that viscerally bring to life some of the literature, the history that seems a bit stodgy to us now. But then when you dig into it, really is very interesting and not at all stodgy.
So if you were to tackle another book, what would it be?
So I always joke and I say Ulysses.
because... James Joyce is Ulysses? Wow.
I always joke with folks and say, that if you were going to choose something really difficult. Yeah. Right?
Well, at least you didn't pick Finnegan's Wake, so.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, I don't know. That would be a huge challenge. So, and right now I'm a little bit tired from 10 years of working on a game about a pond. So we'll see. I'm actually searching for the perfect next step right now.
Tracy Fullerton is the founding director of USC's Game Innovation Lab, and she's the lead developer of Walden, a game. She was talking with Steve Paulson. Hey, want to try it out for yourself? There's a link to where you can play it on our website. That's at ttbook.org. So that's one game. Here's another.
Hey, gang, and welcome to the preview episode of The Foo Show. I'm your host, Will Smith, our very first guest for our very first show.
This one is a TV show, but with a difference. It's in virtual reality. This game is called The Foo Show, and it's hosted by Will Smith. His guests are video game designers, and if you can imagine this, the interviews take place inside video games. So what is it like when everyone, the guests, the audience, the host, are all wearing VR headsets? What's it like to be in that virtual space?
We weren't really sure how long it took people to adjust to the avatars, because we're not looking at each other. We're looking at video game stylized representations of each other.
Well, thank you guys for coming by.
Dude, this is awesome. I want to live here.
You know, they move like people and they look like people, but you know, there's no facial tracking. It looks like a cartoon or a video game character.
Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't sure how long it would take Jake and Sean to adjust to talking to avatars. So, you know, for the first 5 or 6 minutes, they were just kind of looking around like, this is really weird.
I don't even want to go back to my normal reality where things don't just show up in my face.
There you go, Sean.
Oh, there we go. That's my normal reality.
Do I like this? Is my brain okay with this? I'm not sure.
I was totally into this and not freaking out until you touched the back of my head and my animal brain went, where are you?
What is...
And then we got to a point where everybody was comfortable 5 or 10 minutes in, and we just started having a conversation like you and I are right now.
I'm just trying to think what it would be like if you feel like you've met somebody in virtual reality, in virtual space, but never in real space. And then, I don't know, say you ran into them in an airport.
Well, it's funny. These are all things that have happened to me. My lead developer, my team's virtual. I live in San Francisco, and it doesn't make sense to set up offices here because things are so expensive these days. But my lead engineer is in New Mexico, and I met him after working with him for almost a year for the first time at a conference last year. And like, I knew his body language already, because that comes across through the avatars when we're in the studio. You know, we do our stand-up meetings every week in the studio. So, you know, I knew how he moved. I knew how tall he was. And I knew kind of how he looks around, how he moves his head, and how he moves his shoulders, even though it was the first time we'd met in person.
You know, I've read about virtual reality before. This is the first time I experienced it. And the whole space was so amazing to me that, well, I confess I should have just been listening to you, but I was wandering around it because you can move. I'm pulling every book out on the shelf. I tried to pour myself a mug of scotch because there's a bottle of scotch on a desk. I tried to walk out onto the balcony to look at the mountains and the sunset. Maybe that's not so great to make such a wonderful space that your audience gets completely distracted.
Well, I mean, one of the things that we found is that there's two things. One is that when you take away most people's two favorite senses, right? Their sight and their hearing, and you're taking over those senses entirely, you have to give them something that is incredibly engaging. It's a completely different kind of content than, say, if you're making a TV show that you expect people to sit on the couch and watch their iPhone, or making a podcast or a radio show that you expect people to listen to while they're driving home from work. So we wanted to make something that was super, super engaging and had lots of interactivity and lots of things for people to explore. So when you tell me you got lost exploring the environment and weren't really paying attention to the conversation, I'm totally okay with that. I think that's great.
It was a little like what I imagine the experience of being a ghost would be like, because I'm there in the room and I'm watching you guys, but you never acknowledge my presence. I'm so invisible that at one point one of you walked right through me. Which was a really unsettling experience. I don't know. Do people get used to that?
People definitely get used to it. It's something that we're going to work around. We didn't realize you know, everybody on my team spends a lot of time playing video games. So they were kind of used to the weird rules of video games where people sometimes move through your body and things like that. The fly on the wall perspective is a really interesting metaphor for what we do, though, because it's unlike, you know, if you're watching Charlie Rose, you feel like you're at home sitting in your living room because that's what's surrounding you. I have always wanted to sit at the third seat where the camera is on Charlie Rose and kind of have the conversation where I'm looking left, I'm looking right, I'm looking left, I'm looking right while Charlie and his guest are talking to each other. So we were excited that kind of came through in the Foo Show.
Mm. I guess I'm curious thinking about, for instance, how Netflix changed whether people wanted to go out or stay in to see a movie. Is virtual reality going to replace physical experience? Why bother going out to a concert or a show or really anything when you can just put on a headset and explore the world?
I think that what we're going to see VR slot into is, you know, it's just another one of those things that's competing for your entertainment time. Would I rather sit on the couch and watch Netflix reruns of an 80s TV show, or would I rather put on a virtual reality headset and try something new? I'm going to pick VR every time, but that's, you know, that's who I am. And I think that some people will head towards virtual reality experiences, and some people will try VR shooting games, and some people will try VR interactive theater experiences, and some people will load up the thing that lets them sit on top of Mount Everest or go to the Sistine Chapel. You know, I think it's more options for everyone, but I don't see the Ready Player One nightmare dystopia where we're all, you know, slotted into our hovels and use the VR technology to escape the drudgery of our everyday lives.
Well, to me, the most interesting part of the experience actually was what happened at the end when I took the headset off. Because you know how it feels to see a movie in the theater and you get really absorbed. And then when the lights go back up, there's this feeling of being disoriented. Well, it was like that, but worse. Because for a few minutes, that virtual reality actually seemed realer than actual reality, and also possibly better. Like, I was a little disappointed to come back to the real world. Do you get that feeling too?
It kind of fades after you use the headset more. So you lose that that kind of realer than real mind-altering sense after the first few dozen times you put the headset on. So enjoy it while it lasts.
Will Smith is the founder of Foo VR and the host of The Foo Show. And if you want to know more, stay tuned to our podcast feed for a very special virtual reality podcast extra. That's it for this hour. To the best of our knowledge comes to you from Madison, Wisconsin, and the studios of Wisconsin Public Radio. Mark Rickers produced this hour, with help from Doug Gordon and Charles Monroe Kane. Joe Hartke is our sound designer and technical director. Steve Paulson is our executive producer, and I'm Ann Strainchamps. Until next time.